to bathe first, and thus had he discovered, at the age of 20, the incomparable pleasure of submergence in hot water. Who knew? He had not elected to eat in the bath, however, or even to linger beyond the not inconsiderable time it took to get clean, being far too eager to continue talking with Suhaila. She had, on the walk from the Guild Hall, joined his admittedly short list of favourite people, along with Errol Fane, Calixte, Rusa, and Old Master Hurricane. When he saw the quantity of food she'd laid out for him, though, his ingrained abnegation rose to the surface. There were small roast birds and pastries glistening with honey, cubes of meat in fragrant sauce, and curled crustaceans impaled on sticks. There was a salad of grains and another of greens, and a platter of fruit, and a half dozen small bowls of pastes, and another half dozen of salts, and the bread was a disc too big for the table, hanging instead from a hook that existed for this purpose, so that you might just reach up and tear some off. And there were sweets and peppers and tea and wine and it was all too much for him. "I'm so sorry to put you to such trouble," he'd said, earning himself a sharp look.
"Guests aren't trouble," Suhaila had replied. "They're a blessing. Having no one to cook for, now, that's a sadness. But a young man, gaunt from the Almutheleth and in need of fattening, that's a pleasure."
And what could he do but say thank you and eat his fill? Oh, glory! He'd never had a better meal, and he'd never felt so full, or lingered at a table so long, or talked so much, or been so comfortable with someone he'd only just met. And so his introduction to the world of homes and mothers was powerfully good. And though he had felt, on his first walk through the city of his dreams, that he would never be tired again, he was in fact very, very tired, which Suhaila couldn't help but notice.
"Come along," she said. "I've kept you up too late."
Earlier, he had left his travel bag near the door.
"Let me," he said, as she bent to pick it up. "Nonsense," she replied,
and in a flash of a glimpse, he perceived that she had no right hand, only a smooth, tapering wrist, though it didn't hinder her in the slightest, as she hooked the strap of his bag with it and slung it over her shoulder. He wondered that he hadn't noticed it earlier. She showed him to one of the green-painted doors that opened off the courtyard.
"This was my son's room," she said,
gesturing for him to enter.
"Oh, but won't he be wanting it?" "I don't think so," she said with a tinge of sadness in her voice. "Tell me, how does he sleep? Out there?"
She made a vague gesture to the west, indicating, Laszlo supposed, the whole rest of the world.
"I don't know," he answered, surprised. "Well enough."
How inadequate an offering to a worried mother. Well enough. And how would Laszlo know? It had never crossed his mind that Errol Fane might have vulnerabilities. He realized that all this time he'd been looking to the Godslayer as a hero, not a man. But that heroes, whatever else they are also men and women, and prey to human troubles, just like anybody else.
"That's good," said Suhaila. "Perhaps it's gotten better with his being away from here."
"It?" asked Laszlo, remembering the way Errol Fane had averted his eyes and said he didn't sleep well in Weep.
"Oh, nightmares."
Suhaila waved away the subject and laid her hand to Laszlo's cheek.
"It's very good to have you here, young man. Do sleep well."
Moths effused from the chimneys of the Merchants' Guild Hall. It was the hour before dawn. Some in the city were waking. The bakers were already at work, and carts rolled quietly toward the market square, bringing their daily burdens of produce from the valley farms.
Sarai hadn't meant to stay so long in the outsider's dreams, but she'd found in them such an alien world, so full of visions she had no context for, that she had barely felt time passing. The ocean, a vastness unspeakable. Leviathans as big as palaces, harnessed to pontoons to keep them from submerging to their freedom. Glaive mines like buried sunlight, towers like tusks, men with leashed wolves patrolling dazzling blue fields. Such images spoke of a world beyond her ken, and, scattered throughout them, strange among strange, and as difficult to separate from the wild vagaries of dreams as snowflakes from a basket of lace, were the answers she had been seeking. Who were these strangers, and what nature of threat did they pose? As to the first, they were men and women driven by ideas and powered by intelligence and rare skills. Some had families, some did not. Some were kind, some were not. She couldn't possibly know them in one night of trespass. She'd formed impressions, that was all. But as to the second question, Sarai was reeling with visions of explosions and contraptions and impossibly tall towers, and girls climbing impossibly tall towers, and magnets and saws and bridges and flasks of miraculous chemicals and flying machines. "It's not as though they can fly," Feral had said, but it would seem that he was wrong. When Sarai first glimpsed the craft in the dreams of the older of the two Ferengi women, she had dismissed it as fantasy. Dreams are full of flying. It hadn't worried her. But when she saw the same craft in the husband's mind, she had to take notice. The thing was sleek and simple in design, and far too specific to occur by coincidence in two people's dreams, no matter that they lay side by side, touching. Dreams didn't transfer from one sleeper to another. And there was something else that made Sarai believe. She lived in the sky. She knew the world from above in a way that humans didn't. And most dreams of flying just didn't get it right. The reflection of the setting sun on the tops of clouds, the tidal ebb and flow of winds, the look of the world from on high. But this couple, with their rough hands, they knew what it was like. No question about it. They'd been there. So how long before their flying machines were in the air, delivering invaders to the garden terrace and to the flat of the Seraph's Palm, right where Sarai now stood? "Tomorrow we'll know if we need to have this conversation or not," she had told the others last evening, when Minya was rattling them all with her talk of fighting. Well, they would have to have it, and quickly. Little good it would do. Sarai felt sick. Up in the citadel, she turned in her relentless pacing. Her eyes were open, her surroundings a blur. No one was nearby, but she knew the others must be waiting. If they'd slept at all, they'd have risen early to meet her as soon as her moths returned, and hear what she had to tell. Were they just on the other side of her curtain? Even now, she hoped they would stay there until she was ready for them. She considered calling her moths back. Already the eastern horizon was paling, and they would fall dead at the first appearance of the sun. But there was something she still had to do. She'd been putting it off all night. She had to pay a call on the Godslayer. Chapter 26. Broken People. Sarai had come many times to this window, more than to any other in Weep. It was her father's window, and rarely had she let a night pass without a visit to him. A visit to torment him, and herself too, as she tried to imagine being the sort of child that a father could love instead of kill. The window was open. There was no obstacle to entering, but she hesitated and perched the moths on the window ledge to peer inside. There wasn't much to the narrow room. A clothes cupboard, some shelves, and a bed of tidy, tightly packed feather mattresses, covered with hand-embroidered quilts. There was just enough light through the window to give depth to the darkness, so she saw, in shades of black, the contour of a form. A shoulder tapering downward. He was sleeping on his side, his back to the window. Up in her own body, Sarai's heart stammered. She was nervous, flustered even, as though it was some sort of reunion. A one-sided reunion, anyway. It had been 2 years since he went away, and it had been such a relief when he did, to be free of Minya's constant harassment. Every day, the little girl had demanded to know what he dreamed about, and what Sarai had unleashed on her father. Whatever the answer, she was never content. She had wanted Sarai to visit on him such a cataclysm of nightmares as would shatter his mind and leave him spinning through darkness forever. She had wanted Sarai to drive him mad. The Godslayer had always been a threat to them, the greatest threat. He was Weep's beating heart, the liberator of his people, and their greatest hero. No one was more beloved or possessed of more authority, and so no one was more dangerous. After the uprising and the liberation, the humans had been kept very busy. They'd had 2 centuries of tyranny to overcome, after all. They'd had to create a government from nothing, along with laws and a system of justice. They'd had to restore defenses, civil life, industry, and at least the hope of trade. An army, temples, guilds, schools. They'd had to rebuild it all. It had been the work of years, and through it all, the citadel had loomed over their heads, out of their reach. The people of Weep had had no choice but to work at what they could change, and tolerate what they could not, which meant never feeling the sun on their faces, or teaching the constellations to their children, or picking fruit from their own garden trees. There had been talk of moving the city out from under the shadow, starting anew someplace else. A site had even been chosen downriver, but there was far too deep a history here to simply give up. This land had been won for them by angels. Shadowed or not, it was sacred. They had lacked the resources then to take on the citadel, but they were never going to tolerate it forever. Eventually, their resolve was going to focus upward. The Godslayer would not give up.
"If you're not the end of him," Minya would say, "he'll be the end of us."
And Sarai had been Minya's willing weapon. With the carnage red and bloody in her hearts, she'd tried her best and done her worst. So many nights, she'd covered Errol Fane in moths and unleashed every terror in her arsenal. Waves of horrors, ranks of monsters. His whole body would go rigid as a board. She'd heard teeth cracking with the clench of his jaw. Never had eyes been squeezed so tightly shut. It had seemed as though they must rupture. But she couldn't break him. She couldn't even make him cry. Errol Fane had his own arsenal of horrors. He hardly needed hers. Fear was the least of it. Sarai hadn't understood before that fear could be the lesser torment. It was shame that tore him apart. It was despair. There was no darkness she could send him to rival what he'd endured already. He had lived 3 years with Isagol the Terrible. He had survived too much to be driven mad by dreams. It was strange. Every night Sarai split her mind 100 ways, her moths carrying pieces of her consciousness through the city. And when they came back to her, she was whole again. It was easy. But something began to happen the more she tormented her father. A different kind of division within her, and one not so easily reconciled at night's end. To Minya, there would only ever be the carnage. But, in fact, there was so much more. There was before. Stolen girls, lost years, broken people. And always, there were the savage, merciless gods. Isagol, reaching into your soul and playing your emotions like a harp. Letha, dredging your mind, taking out memories and swallowing them whole. Scathis at the door, come for your daughter. Scathis at the door, bringing her back home. The function of hate, as Sarai saw it, was to stamp out compassion, to close a door in one's own self and forget it was ever there. If you had hate, then you could see suffering and cause it, and feel nothing except perhaps a sordid vindication. But at some point, here in this room, Sarai thought, she had lost that capacity. Hate had failed her, and it was like losing a shield in battle. Once it was gone, all the suffering had risen up to overwhelm her. It was too much. It was then that her nightmares turned against her, and she started needing lull. With a deep breath, Sarai disengaged a moth from the ledge and spurred it forward, a single smithereen of darkness dispatched into the dim. In that one sentinel, she focused her attention, and so she was as good as there, hovering just inches above the Godslayer's shoulder. Except, she could hardly have said which sense first vibrated with a small shock of difference, but she understood at once. This was not the Godslayer. The bulk didn't match, nor did the scent of him. Whoever this was, he was slighter than Errol Fane, and sank less deeply into the down. As she adjusted to the scant ambient light, she was able to make out dark hair spilled across the pillow, but little more than that. Who was this, asleep in the Godslayer's bed? Where was Errol Fane? Curiosity overtook her, and she did something she would never have considered in ordinary times. That is to say, in times of less certain doom. There was a glaive on the bedside table, with the black knit cover drawn down over it. Sarai directed a score of moths to it, to grasp the weave with their tiny feet, and shift it back, just enough to uncover a slice of light. If anyone were ever to witness the moths behaving in such a coordinated way, they would have to grow suspicious that these were no natural creatures. But such a fear seemed quaint to Sarai now, compared to her other concerns. With that small task accomplished, she studied the face that was illuminated by the sliver of glaive. She beheld a young man with a crooked nose. His brows were black and heavy, his eyes deep-set. His cheeks were high and flat, and cut to his jaw with the abruptness of an axe chop. No finesse, no elegance. And the nose, it had clearly met with violence, and lent an aspect of violence to the whole. His hair was thick and dark, and where it gleamed in the glaive light, the glints were warm reds, not cool blues. He was shirtless, and though mostly covered by the quilt, the arm that rested over it was corded with lean muscle. He was clean, and must just have shaved for the first time in weeks, as his jaw and chin were paler than the rest of his face, and all but smooth, in that way that a man's face is never truly smooth, even right after an encounter with a perfectly sharpened razor. This Sarai knew from years of perching on sleeping faces, and not from Feral, who, though he had begun to shave, could go days between with no one the wiser. Not this man. He wasn't, like Feral, almost all the way over the line into adulthood, but all the way over it. A man in no uncertain terms. He wasn't handsome. He was certainly no museum piece. There was something of the brute about him with that broken nose. But Sarai found herself lingering longer in the appraisal of him than she had over any of the others, save the golden one. Because they were both young men, and she wasn't so immaculate as to be free of the longings that Ruby expressed so openly, nor so detached that the physical presence of young men had no effect on her. She just kept it to herself, as she kept so many things to herself. Looking at his lashes resting closed, she wondered what color his eyes were, and experienced a pang of alienation, that it should be her lot to see and never be seen, to pass in secret through the minds of others and leave no trace of herself but fear. She took quick stock of the sky. Better hurry. She wouldn't have time to glean much of an impression from this one, but even a hint of who he was might prove useful. A stranger in Errol Fane's house. What did it mean? She drifted a moth onto his brow, and promptly fell into another world. Chapter 27 Another World. Every mind is in its own world. Most occupy a vast middle ground of ordinary, while others are more distinct, pleasant, even beautiful, or sometimes slippery and unaccountably wrong-feeling. Sarai couldn't even remember what her own had been like, back before she had made of it the zoo of terrors it was now. Her own mind a place she was afraid to be caught out in after dark, so to speak, and had to shelter herself from by means of a drink that dulled her with its seeping grey nothing. The Godslayer's dreams were a realm of horrors, too, uniquely his own, while Suhaila's were as soft as a shawl that wraps a child against the cold. Sarai had trespassed in thousands of minds, tens of thousands, and she had sifted her invisible fingers through dreams beyond counting. But she had never known anything like this. She blinked and looked around. Here was a street paved in lapis lazuli, the carved facades of buildings rising up on either side. And there were domes of gold, and the luster of the cusp in the distance. All night long Sarai had sojourned in dreamscapes wholly alien to her. This wasn't, and yet was. She spun slowly, taking in the curious twinning of familiarity and the strange, that was stranger in its way than the wholly alien had been. Clearly this was weep, but it was not the weep she knew. The lapis was bluer, the gold brighter, the carvings unfamiliar. The domes, of which there were hundreds instead of merely dozens, weren't quite the right shape. Nor were they of smooth gold leaf as in reality, but were patterned instead in fish-scale tiles of darker gold and brighter, so the sun didn't merely glint on them. It played. It danced. The sun. The sun on weep. There was no citadel and no anchors, no mesarthium anywhere. Not a trace of lingering gloom or hint of bitterness. She was experiencing a version of weep that existed only in this dreamer's mind. She couldn't know that it was born of tales told years ago by a monk slipping into senility, or that it had been fed ever since by every source Laszlo could get his hands on. That he knew everything that it was possible for an outsider to know about weep, and this was the vision he'd built out of pieces. Sarai had entered into an idea of the city, and it was the most wonderful thing that she had ever seen. It danced over her senses the way the dream sun danced over the domes. Every color was deeper, richer than the real, and there were so many of them. If the weaver of the world itself had kept the snipped ends of every thread she'd ever used, her basket might look something like this. There were awnings over market stalls, and rows of spice shaped into cones. Rose and russet, scarlet and sienna. Old men blew colored smoke through long painted flutes, etching the air with soundless music. Saffron and vermilion, amaranth and coral. From each dome rose a needle-like spire, all of them snapping with swallowtail flags, and interconnected by ribbons, across which children ran laughing, clad in cloaks of colored feathers. Mulberry and citrine, celadon and chocolate. Their shadows kept pace with them down below in a way that could never happen in the true weep, enshrouded as it was in one great shadow. The imaginary citizenry wore garments of simple loveliness, the women's hair long and trailing behind them, or else held aloft by attendant songbirds that were their own sparks of color. Dandelion and chestnut, tangerine and goldenrod. Over the walls vines grew, as they must have done in bygone days, before the shade. Fruits burgeoned, fat and glistening. Sunset and thistle, verdigris and violet. The air was redolent with their honey perfume, and with another scent, one that transported Sarai back to childhood. When she was small, before the pantries of the citadel kitchens were emptied of irreplaceable provisions like sugar and white flour, Great Ellen used to make them a birthday cake each year. One to share, to stretch the sugar and white flour across as many years as possible. Sarai had been 8 for the last one. The 5 of them had savored it, made a game of eating it with excruciating slowness, knowing it was the last cake they would ever taste. And here in this strange and lovely weep were cakes set out on window ledges, their icing glittering with crystal sugar and flower petals, and passers-by stopped to help themselves to a slice of this one or that one, and folks inside handed cups out through the windows so that they might have something to wash it down with. Sarai drank it all in a daze. This was the second time tonight she had been surprised by the stark dissonance between a face and a mind. The first had been the golden Ferengi. However fine his face, not so his dreams. They were as cramped and airless as coffins. He could barely breathe or move in them, and neither could she. And now this. That this rugged countenance with its air of violence should give her entrance into such a realm of wonder. She saw spectrals parading unattended, side by side like couples out for a stroll, and other such creatures as she recognized and didn't. A ravid, its arm-long fangs festooned in beads and tassels, rose up on its hind legs to lick a cake with its long, rasping tongue. She saw a genteel centaur bearing a princess side-saddle, and such was the atmosphere of magic that they weren't out of place here. He turned his head and the pair shared a lingering kiss that brought warmth to Sarai's cheeks. And there were small men with the feet of chickens, walking backwards so their tracks would point the wrong way, and tiny old ladies racing about on saddled cats, and goat-horned boys ringing bells, and the flit and flutter of gossamer wings, and more and lovelier things everywhere she looked. She'd been inside the dream for less than a minute. 2 mere spans of the great seraph's hand paced forth and back when she realized that she had a smile on her face. A smile. Smiles were rare enough, given the nature of her work. But on such a night as this, with such discoveries, it was unthinkable. She pushed it flat with her hand, ashamed, and paced on. So this Ferengi was good at dreams. So what? None of this was useful to her. Who was this dreamer? What was he doing here? Hardening herself to wonder, she looked around again and saw, up ahead, the figure of a man with long dark hair. It was him. This was normal. People manifest in their own dreams more often than they don't. He was walking away from her, and she willed herself nearer, no sooner wishing it than she was right behind him. This dream might be special, but it was still a dream, and, as such, hers to control. She could, if she wished, vanquish all this color. She might turn it all to blood, smash the domes, send the feather-cloaked children tumbling to their deaths. She might drive that tame ravid with its tassels and beads to maul the lovely women with their long black hair. She could turn all this into nightmare. Such was her gift. Her vile, vile gift. She did none of that. It wasn't why she'd come, for one thing. But even if it was unthinkable that she should mangle this dream. It wasn't just the colors and the fairy tale creatures, the magic. It wasn't even the cakes. There was such a feeling here of sweetness and safety. And Sarai wished. She wished it were real. And she could live in it. If ravids could walk here side by side with men and women, and even share their cakes, then maybe Godspawn could too. Real. Foolish, foolish thought. This was a stranger's mind. Real was the other 4 waiting for her in an agony of wondering. Real was the truth she had to tell them. And real was the dawn glow creeping up the horizon. It was time to go. Sarai gathered up her moths. Those perched on the knitted glaive cover released it, and it eased back down, swallowing the slice of light and returning the dreamer to darkness. They fluttered to the window and waited there, but the one on his brow remained. Sarai was poised, ready to withdraw it, but she hesitated. She was so many places at once. She was on the flat of the Seraph's palm, barefoot, and she was hovering in the window of the Godslayer's bedroom, and she was perched, light as a petal, on the dreamer's brow. And she was inside his dream, standing right behind him. She had an unaccountable urge to see his face, here in this place of his creation, with his eyes open. He reached out to pluck a fruit from one of the vines. Sarai's hand twitched at her side, wanting one too. Wanting five, one for each of them. She thought of the godspawn girl who could bring things out of dreams, and wished she could return with her arms full of fruit, a cake balanced on her head, and riding the tame rabbit that now had icing on its whiskers. As though, with gifts and whimsy, she might soften the blow of her news. Some children were climbing a trellis, and they paused to toss some more fruit down to the dreamer. He caught the yellow orbs and called back, "Thank you!" The timbre of his voice sent a thrill through Sarai. It was deep, low, and raw. A voice like wood smoke, serrated blades, and boots breaking through snow. But for all its roughness, there was the most endearing hint of shyness in it, too. "I believed it when I was a little boy," he told an old man standing nearby, "about the fruit free for the taking. But later I thought it had to be a fantasy, dreamed up for hungry children." Belatedly, it struck Sarai that he was speaking the language of Weep. All night long, in all those other strangers' dreams, she'd heard scarcely a word she could understand. But this one was speaking it without even an accent. She drifted to one side, coming around finally to get a look at him. She went right up close, studying him, in profile, in the same shameless way that one might study a statue, or, indeed, in which a ghost might study the living. Earlier in the night, she had done the same with the golden Ferengi, standing right beside him while he did furious work in a laboratory of spurting flames and shattered glass. Everything had been jagged there, hot and full of peril, and it didn't matter how beautiful he was. She'd been eager to get away. There was no peril here, or desire for escape. On the contrary, she was drawn in closer. A decade of invisibility had done away with any hesitancy she might once have felt about such flagrant staring. She saw that his eyes were grey, and that his smile wore the same hint of shyness as his voice. And yes, there was the broken line of his nose. And yes, the cut of his cheeks to his jaw was harsh. But to her surprise, his face, awake and animate, conveyed none of the brutality that had been her first impression. On the contrary, it was as sweet as the air in his dream. He turned his head her way, and Sarai was so accustomed to her own acute non-being that it didn't even startle her. She only took it as an opportunity to see him better. She had seen so many closed eyes, and eyelids trembling with dreams, and lashes fluttering on cheeks, that she was transfixed by his open ones. They were so near. She could see, in this indulgence of sunlight, the patterns of his irises. They weren't solid grey, but filaments of 100 different greys and blues and pearls, and they looked like reflections of light wavering on water, with the softest sunburst of amber haloing his pupils. And, every bit as avidly as she was looking at him, he was looking at... No, not at her. He could only be looking through her. He had an air of one bewitched. There was a light in his eyes of absolute wonder. Witch light, she thought. And she suffered a deep pang of envy for whoever or whatever it was behind her that enthralled him so completely. For just a moment, she let herself pretend that it was her. That he was looking at her in that rapt way. It was only pretend. an instant of self-indulgence, like a phantom that interposes itself between lovers to feel what it is to be alive. All of this happened in a flutter of seconds, three at the very most. She stood quiet inside the remarkable dream, and pretended the dreamer was captivated by her. She tracked the movement of his pupils. They seemed to trace the lines of her face and the band of black she'd painted across it. They dropped, only to rise again at once from the sight of her slip-clad form and her immodest blue skin. He blushed, and sometime in those 3 seconds it had ceased being pretend. Sarai blushed, too. She fell back a step, and the dreamer's eyes followed her. His eyes followed her. There was no one behind her. There was no one else at all. The whole dream shrank to a sphere around the pair of them, and there could be no question that the witchlight was for her, or that it was her he meant when he whispered, with vivid and tender enthrallment, "Who are you?" Reality came slamming down. She was seen. She was seen. Up in the citadel, Sarai jerked back. She snapped the tether of consciousness and cut the moth loose, losing the dream in an instant. All the focus she'd poured into the single sentinel was shunted back into her physical body, and she stumbled and fell, gasping, to her knees. It was impossible. In dreams, she was a phantom. He couldn't have seen her. Yet there was no question in her mind that he had. Down in Weep, Laszlo woke with a start, and sat up in bed just in time to witness 99 smithereens of darkness spook from his window ledge and burst into the air, where, with one frantic eddy, they were sucked up and out of sight. He blinked. All was quiet and still. Dark, too. He might have doubted that he'd seen anything at all if, at that moment, the 100th moth hadn't tumbled off his brow to fall dead into his lap. Gently, he scooped it into his palm. It was a delicate thing, its wings furred in plush the color of twilight. Half-tangled in the remnants of his dream, Laszlo was still seeing the wide blue eyes of the beautiful blue girl, and he was frustrated to have wakened and lost her so abruptly. If he could get back to the dream, he wondered, might he find her again? He laid the dead moth on the bedside table and fell back to sleep. And he did find the dream, but not the girl. She was gone. In those next moments, the sun rose. It seeped a pallid light into the citadel's gloom and turned the moth to smoke on the table. When Laszlo woke again, a couple of hours later, he'd forgotten them both. Chapter 28. No Way to Live. Sarai fell to her knees. All she was seeing was the pure and potent focus of the dreamer's eyes, on her, as Feral, Ruby, and Sparrow rushed out to her from the doorway where they'd been watching and waiting.
"Sarai, are you all right?"
"What is it? What's wrong?"
"Sarai!"
Minya came behind them, but she didn't rush to Sarai's side. She held herself back, watching with keen interest as they took her elbows and helped her up. Sarai saw their distress and mastered her own, pushing the dreamer from her mind, for now. He had seen her. What could it mean? The others were peppering her with questions. Questions she couldn't answer, because her moths hadn't yet come back to her. They were in the sky now, racing the rising sun. If they didn't make it back in time, she would be voiceless until dark fell and a new 100 were born in her. She didn't know why it worked that way, but it did. She clutched her throat so the others would understand, and she tried to wave them inside so they wouldn't see what happened next. She hated for anyone to see her moths come or go. But they only drew back, apprehension on their faces. And all she could do when the moths came frothing up over the edge of the terrace was turn away to hide her face as she opened her mouth wide to let them back in. 99. In her shock, She'd severed the connection and left the moth on the dreamer's brow. Her heart gave a lurch. She reached out with her mind, fumbling for the cut tether, as though she might revive the moth and draw it back home. But it was lost to her. First she'd been seen by a human, and then she'd left a moth behind like a calling card. Was she coming undone? How had he seen her? She was pacing again, out of habit. The others came beside her, demanding to know what had happened. Minya still stood back, watching. Sarai reached the end of the palm, turned, and stopped. There were no railings on this terrace to prevent one from stepping off the edge. There was, instead, the subtle curve of the cupped hand, the metal flesh sloping gently upward to form a kind of great shallow bowl, so that you couldn't simply walk off the edge. Even at her most distracted, Sarai's feet kept track of the slope, and knew to stay in the palm's flat center. Now the panic of the others brought her back to herself.
"Tell us, Sarai," said Feral,
holding his voice steady to show that he could take it. Ruby was on one side of him, Sparrow on the other. Sarai drank in the sight of their faces. She'd taken so little time over the past years simply to be with them. They lived by day, and she by night, and they shared one meal in between. It was no way to live, but it was living, and it was all they had. In a fragile whisper, she said,
"They have flying machines."
And watched, desolate, as the understanding changed their three faces, bullying out the last defiant shred of hope, leaving nothing but despair. She felt like her mother's daughter then. Sparrow's hands flew to her mouth.
"So that's it then," said Ruby.
They didn't even question it. Somehow, in the night, they'd passed through panic to defeat. Not Minya.
"Look at you all,"
she said, scathing.
"I swear, you look ready to fall to your knees and expose your throats to them."
Sarai turned to her. Minya's excitement had brightened. It appalled her.
"How can you be happy about this?" "It had to happen sooner or later,"
was her answer.
"Better to get it over with." "Over with? What? Our lives?"
Minya scoffed.
"Only if you'd sooner die than defend yourselves. I can't stop you if you're that set on dying, but it's not what I'll be doing."
A silence gathered. It occurred to Sarai, and perhaps to the other three at the same time, that yesterday, when Minya had scorned their varying levels of uselessness in a fight, she had made no mention of what her own part might be. Now, in the face of their despair, she radiated eagerness. Zeal. It was so utterly wrong that Sarai couldn't even take it in.
"What's wrong with you?"
she demanded.
"Why are you so pleased?" "I thought you'd never ask,"
Minya said, with a grin that showed all her little teeth.
"Come with me. I want to show you something."
The Godslayer's family home was a modest example of the traditional Weep Yeldes, or courtyard house. From the outside, it presented a stone facade carved in a pattern of lizards and pomegranates. The door was stout and painted green. It gave access to a passage straight through to a courtyard. This was open and was the home's central and primary room, used for cooking, dining, gathering. Weep's mild climate meant that most living happened out of doors. It also meant that, once upon a time, the sky had been their ceiling, and now the citadel was. Only the bedrooms, water closet, and winter parlor were fully enclosed. They surrounded the courtyard in a U, and opened onto it through four green doors. The kitchen was recessed into a covered alcove, and a pergola around the dining area would once have been covered with climbing vines for shade. There would have been trees and a herb garden. Those were gone now. A scrub of pallid shrubs survived, and there were some pots of delicate forest flowers that could grow without much sun, but they were no match for the lush picture in Laszlo's mind. When he stepped out of his room in the morning, he found Suhaila pulling a fish trap out of the well. This was less strange than it might seem, as it wasn't really a well, but a shaft cut down to the river that flowed beneath the city. The Uzumak wasn't a single, massive subterranean channel, but an intricate network of waterways that carved their way through the valley bedrock. When the city was built, the brilliant early engineers had adapted these to a system of natural plumbing. Some streams were for fresh water, some for waste disposal. Others, larger, were glaive-lit subterranean canals plied by long, narrow boats. From east to west, there was no faster way to traverse the long oval of the city than by underground boat. There was even rumor of a great buried lake, deeper than everything, in which a prehistoric Svitogor was trapped by its immense size and lived like a goldfish in a bowl, feeding on eels that bred in the cool spring water. They called it the Kalisma, which meant eel god, as it would to the eels certainly seem that way.
"Good morning," said Laszlo, coming into the courtyard.
"Ah, you're up,"
returned Suhaila, merry. She opened the trap and the small fish flickered green and gold as she spilled them into a bucket.
"Slept well, I hope?"
"Too well," he said. "And too late. I hate to be a layabout. I'm sorry."
"Nonsense. If ever there's a time for sleeping in, I'd say it's the morning after crossing Bielmutheleth. And my son hasn't turned up yet, so you haven't missed anything."
Laszlo caught sight of the breakfast that was set out on the low stone table. It was almost equal to the dinner spread from the night before, which made sense, since it was Suhaila's first opportunity to feed Errol Fane in over 2 years.
"Can I help you?" he asked.
"Put the cover back on the well."
He did as she asked, then followed her to the open fire, where he watched as she cleaned the fish with a few deft flicks of a knife, dunked them in oil, dredged them in spices, and laid them on the grill. He could hardly imagine her being more dexterous if she'd had two hands instead of just the one. She saw him looking. More to the point, she saw him look away when caught looking. She held up the smooth, tapered stump of her wrist and said,
"I don't mind. Have an ogle."
He blushed, abashed.
"I'm sorry."
"I'm going to impose a fine on apologies," she said. "I didn't like to mention it last night, but today is your new beginning. 10 silver every time you say you're sorry."
Laszlo laughed, and had to bite his tongue before apologizing for apologizing.
"It was trained into me," he said. "I'm helpless."
"I accept the challenge of retraining you. Henceforth, you are only allowed to apologize if you tread on someone's foot while dancing."
"Only then? I don't even dance."
"What? Well, we'll work on that, too."
She flipped the fish on the grill. The smoke was fragrant with spice.
"I've spent all my life in the company of old men," Laszlo told her. "If you're hoping to make me fit for society, you'll have your hands full."
The words were out before he could consider them. His face flamed, and it was only her holding up a warning finger that prevented him from apologizing.
"Don't say it," she said.
Her effect was stern, but her eyes danced.
"You mustn't worry about offending me, young man. I'm quite impervious. As for this..."
She held up her wrist.
"I almost think they did me a favor. 10 seems an excessive number of fingers to keep track of, and so many nails to pair."
Her grin infected Laszlo, and he grinned too.
"I never thought of that. You know, there's a goddess with 6 arms in Myelin myth. Think of her.
Poor dear. But then she probably has priestesses to groom her.
That's true. Suhaila forked the cooked fish into a dish, which she handed to him, gesturing toward the table. He carried it over and found a spot for it. Her words were stuck in his head, though.
I almost think they did me a favor.
Who was they?
Forgive me, but... 10 silver.
What?
You apologized again. I warned you.
I didn't, Laszlo argued, laughing. Forgive me is a command. I command that you forgive me. It's not an apology at all.
Fine, allowed Suhaila. But next time, no qualifiers. Just ask.
All right, said Laszlo. But never mind. It's none of my business.
Just ask.
You said they did you a favor. I was just wondering who you meant.
Ah, well, that would be the gods.
For all the floating citadel overhead, Laszlo had as yet no clear context for what life had been under the gods.
They cut off your hand.
I assume so, she said. Of course I don't remember. They may have made me do it myself. All I know is I had 2 hands before they took me, and 1 after.
All of this was spoken like ordinary morning conversation.
Took you, Laszlo repeated. Up there.
Suhaila's brow furrowed, as though she were perplexed by his ignorance.
Hasn't he told you anything?
He gathered that she meant Errol Fane.
Until we stood on the cusp yesterday, we didn't even know why we'd come.
She chuffed with surprise.
Well, aren't you the trusting things to come all this way for a mystery?
Nothing could have kept me from coming, Laszlo confessed. I've been obsessed with the mystery of Weep all my life.
Really? I had no idea the world even remembered us.
Laszlo's mouth skewed to one side.
The world doesn't really. Just me.
Well, that shows character, said Suhaila. And what do you think, now that you're here?
All the while she'd been chopping fruit, and she made a broad gesture with her knife.
Are you satisfied with the resolution of your mystery?
Resolution?
He repeated with a helpless laugh, and looked up at the citadel.
I have 100 times more questions than I did yesterday.
Suhaila followed his glance, but no sooner did she lift her eyes than she lowered them again and shuddered. Like the Tizercane on the cusp, she couldn't bear the sight of it.
That's to be expected, she said. If my son hasn't prepared you.
She laid down her knife and swept the chopped fruit into a bowl, which she passed to Laszlo.
He never could talk about it.
He'd started to turn away to carry the bowl to the table, when she added quietly,
They took him longer than anyone, you know.
He turned back to her. No, he really did not know. He wasn't sure how to form his thoughts into a question, and before he could, Suhaila, busying herself wiping up the cutting board, went on in the same quiet way.
Mostly they took girls, she said. Raising a daughter in Weep, and, well, being a daughter in Weep, was very hard in those years. Every time the ground shook, you knew it was Scathis coming to your door.
Scathis.
Rusa had said that name.
But sometimes they took our sons, too.
She scooped tea into a strainer.
They took children.
One's child is always one's child, of course. But technically, or physically at least, he waited until they were of age.
Of age. Those words.
Laszlo swallowed a rising sensation of nausea. Those words were like... they were like seeing a bloody knife. You didn't need to have witnessed the stabbing to understand what it meant.
I worried for Azarine more than for Errol Fane. For her, it was only a matter of time. They knew it, of course. That's why they married so young. She said she wanted to be his before she was theirs. And she was. For 5 days. But it wasn't her they took. It was him. Well, they got her later.
This was. It was unspeakable, all of it. Azarine, Errol Fane. The routine nature of atrocity.
But they're married,
was what Laszlo asked.
Oh,
Suhaila looked rueful.
You didn't know. Well, no secret safe with me, is it?
But why should it be a secret?
It's not that it's a secret,
she said carefully.
It's more that it's not a marriage anymore. Not after...
She tipped her head up toward the citadel without looking at it. Laszlo didn't ask any more questions. Everything he'd wondered about Errol Fane and Azarine had taken on a much darker cast than he could ever have imagined. And so had the mysteries of Weep.
So, we were taken up to serve,
Suhaila went on, her pronoun shift reminding him that she had herself been one of these taken girls.
That's what Scathis called it. He would come to the door, or the window.
Her hand trembled, and she clasped it tight over her stump.
They hadn't brought any servants with them. So there was that, serving at table, or in the kitchens. And there were chambermaids, gardeners, laundresses.
In this litany, it was somehow very clear that these jobs, they were the exceptions, and that service had mostly been of another kind.
Of course, we didn't know any of this until later, when they brought us back. And they didn't always. But usually, and usually within a year, we wouldn't remember a thing. Gone for a year gone from us.
She dropped her stump, and her hand fluttered briefly to her belly.
It was as though no time had passed. Letha would eat our memories, you see.
She looked up at Laszlo then.
She was the goddess of oblivion.
It made sense now. Horrible sense. Why Suhaila didn't know what had become of her own hand.
And Errol Fane?
He asked, steeling himself. Suhaila looked back down at the teapot she was filling with steaming water from the kettle.
Oblivion was a mercy, it turns out. He remembers everything. Because he slew them, and there was no one left to take his memories away.
Laszlo understood what she was telling him, what she was saying without saying it. But it didn't seem possible. Not Errol Fane, who was power incarnate. He was a liberator, not a slave.
3 years, said Suhaila. That's how long she had him. Isagol, goddess of despair.
Her eyes lost focus. She seemed to slip into some great hollow place within her, and her voice sank to a whisper.
But then, if they'd never taken him, we would all of us still be slaves.
For that brief moment, Laszlo felt a tremor of the quaking grief within her, that she had not been able to keep her child safe. That was a simple and profound grief, but under it was a deeper, stranger one. That in some way she had to be glad of it, because if she had kept him safe, he couldn't have saved his people. It mixed up gladness, grief, and guilt into an intolerable brew.
I'm so sorry, said Laszlo.
from the depths of both his hearts. Suhaila snapped out of whatever faraway, hollow place she was lost in. Her eyes sharpened back to smiling squints.
Ha!
She said.
10 silver, please.
And she held out her palm.